Welcome to episode 206, Shaping a Secure Sense of Self Using EFIT, featuring Dr. Sue Johnson. For information about the free CE credit associated with this podcast interview, please visit us at clearlyclinical.com on the free podcast CE courses page. By Clearly Clinical, learn, grow, shine. Please note that this episode discusses self-harming behaviors, suicide, abuse, and other traumatic experiences, including discussion of redacted case examples.
Hello to our listeners. My name is Beth Irias, and I am just beside myself to be joined today by none other than Dr. Sue Johnson. She has been kind enough to join us for a conversation about a relatively new model that she has been spearheading about emotionally focused individual therapy, and I am very excited to hear from her. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Johnson.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
So before we dive into this, for the therapist who is not familiar with you or your work, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us about how you came onto the stage as one of these psychotherapy greats?
Oh, sure. I think I came onto the stage because I was a completely crazed, on fire graduate student who, when I look back on it, there was something wrong with me. I was completely on fire the whole time with psychotherapy and growing people. This was my thing, how to grow people. How did people grow and change? I was caught by that. I'm still caught by that, actually. But you know, I was a grad student, and I'd done every kind of therapy, group therapy with violent men and with kids and with, you know, family therapy, individual therapy. I'd done it all. So I was feeling kind of confident and kind of like, you know, hey, you know, I'm going to be called Dr. Sue and I'm going to be good at this. And then I went to a clinic and I was told I'm going to see couples, distressed couples. And I remember thinking, that's fine. You know, how hard can it be? And I remember my first few couple sessions when I realized I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know how to do this and nothing works. Nothing that's in the literature, like, you know, getting the couple to make deals, you know, getting them to negotiate, you know, that doesn't work. Somehow it's missing the mark, and I don't quite know why. And doing insight therapy, talking about their past, doesn't work. So thank goodness I decided to just tape all my couples and start watching them. And as I did that, I watched them again and again and again. As, like I said, I was insane. Okay. I was a crazy graduate student. So I kept watching them again and again and again. And gradually I saw patterns. And I started to understand that the patterns were sort of stuck. You know, the pattern always recurred. The couple always ended up in the same place, usually with one person blaming and demanding and getting enraged, and another person shutting down and moving away. And the more the person shut down and shut the other person out, the more enraged the other one would get, and they would go on like this. And then I started, because I was trained as a Rogerian therapist, helping people talk on a different level and about their emotions. And they started having these different kinds of conversations. And not only did the relationship change, the dancers changed. The couple started growing each other. They started help. One couple partner started helping the other with their depression. They got less depressed. Or one partner started turning for comfort in their PTSD flashbacks to the other. And I was just enthralled by this. So I insisted on doing an outcome study for my thesis, which was ridiculous and should have killed me, nearly did. And I got hooked on understanding love, understanding bonding, which in those days, believe it or not, romantic love was not really considered an emotional bond. It was considered kind of a sexual infatuation, that kind of the infatuation sort of faded after a while and you were left with kind of a deal, a friendship, right? That was the kind of, and I knew that wasn't right. So I just got caught in 30 years of research and teaching people about couples. And I realized what I wanted was to change the field of couple therapy. so that no young therapist was ever in the position I was in again of going in and sitting down with a distressed couple and going, I don't know what to do now. I don't know what to do. Right? There's nothing I can do. I think this may be arrogant, but I think we've done that. If you go and look at our ICEF site, www.iceeft.com, you'll see pages and pages of research. I looked at it the other day. I don't know where it's all come from. It's just amazing to me. And pages of outcome studies and process of change studies. It's not enough to create change. If you're a therapist, you have to know what you did to create the change. Otherwise, you can't really teach, okay? So we are at the point where we know that. We know what you have to do to create change with couples. And we know from our follow-up studies that our changes last that we make in therapy. And that's because we create bonding conversations. So as part of this journey, I got completely caught in attachment science, adult attachment. Believe it or not, until the turn of the century, to talk about adult attachment was, in psychology, it was death, okay? It was people would walk out of my seminars. I would get all my papers rejected. I would be told, you don't understand. You're dealing with fusion, symbiosis, codependency. I'd say, no, I'm not. I'm dealing with people desperate to create an emotional bond, which is the main thing that human beings need. And people would say, you're dangerous, you're weird, you're strange, you're So it was kind of flattering, actually, to be seen as dangerous. You know, I'm small, you know, I'm small Canadian female. We're quite polite in Canada. So to be seen as dangerous was like, oh, all right, I'm sort of dangerous. And you know, it took a long time for people to really start to listen to all the wonderful science behind adult attachment. But I think it's much more established now. But then I started seeing more and more traumatized couples where one person was traumatized. And I got really caught up in the fact that the work that we did was very powerful for the traumatized client themselves, not just the couple. And, you know, if you help the couple create a secure bond, that's the ideal healing environment for someone who's gone through trauma. But anyway, I got all caught up in that. And at the same time, I moved out here to the West Coast with my best clinical student I ever had, who is just a wonderful clinician. And we started looking at tapes of individuals with trauma that we were working with. I'd always done that all through my career, but I'd never talked about it. I'd always focused on couples. And we started looking at tapes and getting incredibly excited about the changes that were happening. And so before you knew where it was, there was something called EFIT, Emotionally Focused Individual Therapy. Don't you love the acronym EFIT? I said to her the other day, I said to Leanne Campbell, fit for life, fit for love, EFIT, you know, so. And the, yes, absolutely. Well, the point of EFIT, you know, the point of EFT for couples is to create a secure bond between partners, not just to deal with the symptoms of distress. That's the booby prize, is to create a positive, secure bond that supports these people to grow in their lives, okay? We're into growth. We're an experiential therapy a la Rogers. We're into growth. We don't just want to change symptoms. So, you know, that's kind of where we came from. And, you know, we gradually began to look and see that, you know, it was the same process as we had done all these years with couples, but, you know, there were some slight changes, but it was the same process and using the same skills and the same perspective, using an attachment perspective. And it just started to take off. We just got the same kind of crazy passion that I had years ago with couples, where I just get so excited. And we wrote a book that came out 2 years ago called The Primer in Emotionally Focused Individual Therapy. And, you know, I thought, this is crazy. I'm known as a couples therapist. I'm known as the, you know, people say things like, oh, you know, Sue cracked the code of love. I didn't actually. John Bowlby cracked the code of love. It's very nice to say that I did, but I didn't. But hopefully I bought it into psychotherapy and into couples. But, you know, we started to just get all fired up about this. We wrote the primer, which came out 2 years ago with Routledge, and we've kept on teaching it and doing it. So now EFIT is out there in the world, emotionally focused individual therapy. And it's the same as EFT for couples, our well-known therapy, which is that it prioritizes emotion, because emotion is the factor, the variable that basically defines, colors, you know, creates your inner world and your relational world. The emotional music you send to your partner is what the two of you dance with. So, you know, we focus on emotion still. We befriend it, follow it, help regulate it, help people accept it, move into it and through it, just like we do in couples, except that our goal is not a secure bond with another person per se who's in the room. Our goal is a secure connection with your sense of self, so that you can, at the end of EFIT, go into your inner reality. You can order it, face it with balance, trust it, listen to it, use the emotions that are going on there as a guide, as a compass. You can keep your balance in very distressing situations, you know, and you feel confident and competent in your ability to define who you are and to deal with your experience as it comes towards you. You know, EFT is an experiential therapy. So what we do is we go in to people's lived present experience in the moment. How are you feeling right now as you say this to me? Is a classic EFT question. You know, we go into people's lived experience and look at how they're constructing that in the moment, and then start to move in there and kind of see the patterns and look at it and order it in a different way with the client. So it's the same process as we've studied for 35 years and that we have all kinds of research on with couples. It's the same process, except that you are working on the client's relationship with themselves rather than the relationship with the person who's sitting across from them, you know. And it's quite similar in lots of ways, actually. You know, people come in and they say, I'm just defective. I'm a bad person. There's something wrong with me. Nobody would want who I am. This is a lot like couples. In couples, the person says it's about the other person. Well, they just don't know how to be a husband. You know, they just don't know how to talk. And, you know, I didn't sign up for this. You know, they're on their computer all the time. And it's, you know, it's the same sort of story, but it's in relation to self. So what we want at the end of EFIT is a secure, balanced connection with self. And you'd be amazed at the things people say to us. Like, the most traumatized lady I've ever worked with is in the primer of book on EFIT. She's called Henny. And when she comes to me, she doesn't remember the first time she was raped by her father. And she remembers seeing her sisters raped, but she doesn't remember her being raped. Well, she does. In about session 25, she stays with me for 40 sessions. She remembers being raped, and she is able to go through it with me. I'm with her from an attachment point of view. I'm not just supporting her as a therapist, a professional. I, Sue, am with Henny while she goes through this. And she knows that I'm there with her. So she has a resource. She's not alone. Attachment tells us that the key iatrogenic factor in mental health issues is always that you feel alone and unseen and unvalued by others. So she's not alone, and she goes through it. And at the end of it, I'm quite worried how she's going to integrate all this. She says she's fine. So I, in the next session, when we get together, I've told her you can call me during the week. She doesn't call me. In the next session, I say, Henny, I'm worried about you. You went through so much in the last session. What's happening? She says, I'm fine, Sue. And I basically say, how can you possibly be fine? You know, I don't say you're the most abused human being I've ever met. I don't say that. But how can you possibly be fine after what you have gone through last time? And she said, well, you see, I am, because now I have me. And that, I think, is very significant, because that's what we're trying to get to in EFIT. We're trying to get to the point. And people say it all the time, unbidden by us. It's amazing. People say, it's okay, because now I can trust me. Now I can feel, I know what happened to me now, and I can make sense of it. And I know the feelings that come up for me, and it's okay. I can trust me. I can deal with this now. And people are amazing. They're resilient, and you know, which is what Bowlby and Rogers, who never met, it's such a shame they never met. They would have loved each other. Both said, they said, if you create a safe place, a really safe place, which I think I worry that we're not teaching our young therapists to do, if you create a really safe place, I mean an attachment safe haven, not just a comfy relationship, okay? Not just a professional alliance, right? If you create a really safe place, people, and you lead them gradually into the emotions that are difficult and unacceptable and frightening, which is the core of all mental health problems and relational problems. If you lead them into that, those difficult emotions, and they come with you, they grow. They naturally grow. Growth is natural for human beings when we feel safe and we can explore. But we won't do that if we're threatened and alone. Why would we? It would be dysfunctional for us as evolutionary beings. It would be dysfunctional for us if we're threatened and alone to sit and go into our most frightening emotions. But if you have somebody there with you who can be with you and guide you, yes, people will do that, and they'll naturally grow. And, you know, both Bowlby and Rogers believed that belonging led to becoming, that when you feel safe and connected with another human being, you can explore your inside. You can explore how you dance with others. You can grow. You can explore. So I don't know what question you asked, but I've gone on an awful long time telling you what EFIT is. The point of EFIT is to create a secure connection with self. And then you can go and create more secure connection with other people.
I love that you went and explained it, because it was such a brilliant primer for what EFT is and how EFIT, EFIT, bloomed out of that. Goodness knows, having this conversation with you, Dr. Johnson, I have known your name since the very beginning of my clinical career. And I had the good fortune of a clinical supervisor who was one of the early adopters of EFT, of emotionally focused therapy. And this, for me, makes so much sense, because it sounds like you're saying EFIT is basically taking the same principles from EFT about building safety in the relationship and just simply switching the dyad to not be the couple in front of you, but to be between client and therapist. Is that right?
That's right. And it doesn't matter from an EFT point of view who you have in the room, whether you have you and all the feelings that you have that there's something wrong with you and that life's impossible and you're overwhelmed, right? And you shouldn't feel the feelings you feel. Whether you just have you and all these parts of you that you can't do anything with, right? That you get hijacked by all these fears and terrible feelings about self. Whether you have you and your partner who trigger all these fears about self, and who, you know, you get caught in this dreadful dance with, where you're stuck with, the more you dance, the more insecure you become. And the more desperately you try to get the other person to respond to you, you know, you will, I hear clients say, like, you will respond to me. Well, unfortunately, the way you're doing that almost ensures the person won't be able to respond to you. That's the irony with that one. You know, I'll make you respond to me, I'll scream at you so loud, you have to respond. And of course, the other person shuts down. And then we know what happens after that. You get into demand withdrawal. But whether you're alone in the room with these representations of self, which mostly come from your past, you know, a lot from adult from attachment figures in your past, from parents, right, and the people who are important to you. You know, whether you're alone in the room, whether you're with a partner who you're triggered by, or whether you're with family members who you're triggered by, it doesn't matter. It's the same process of listening to the emotional music that's defining the dance with self, with one other, with a number of others. Listening to the emotional music, understanding the key longings and terrors that are in that music, which attachment gives us a map to. You know, the essence of EFIT and EFT is attunement. The therapist tunes into the client with relentless empathy. And I mean relentless. I mean, it's got to keep going, okay? It's relentless empathy. But you can only do that if you have kind of a map of what is inside and what our basic needs and fears and terrors are. And attachment gives us that. So, you know, I have an incredible, it's more than a tool. It's like a map. When a client comes in and sits in front of me, you know, I already know that they're struggling with shame, sadness, and fear, usually fear of abandonment or fear of rejection. I already know that, right? And I already know that there's only so many ways to deal with those emotions. I mean, we're wonderful, complex human beings, and we're not. We're actually quite simple. You know, when we get real frantic, we either up the ante and start screaming our heads off, right? Or we shut down and numb out. As my client said to me the other day, I don't want to feel. I'm not going to feel. You're going to try to make me feel. I'm not going to feel. I want a therapy where I don't have to feel because I don't like it. And also, I can't live numb like this. So that's a classic dilemma, client dilemma. I'm stuck either way. My two ways of dealing with emotion, neither of them work, and I'm stuck, right? And we think of people as stuck, not as dysfunctional, bad, all the other words that you can use. We certainly don't use the DSM. I think it confuses as much as anything else. It doesn't help at all. The book I wrote before the primer, Attachment Theory in Practice, I talk about David Barlow, who's a behaviorist. David Barlow's way of thinking about mental health problems, which is basically, it's all about emotional dysregulation. Of course it is. Bessel van der Kolk in his book on trauma says, it's all about emotional dysregulation. Then it seems to me the field of psychotherapy says, it's all about emotional dysregulation. Let's just ignore emotion and go to cognition and our bodies and, you know, theories of what you can tell people to persuade them not to feel this way. You say, no, don't be silly. If it's all about emotion, just go straight into the emotion. Well, you have to know how to do it and you have to know how to have a map. But if you do have a map and you can befriend emotion and follow it, it's the most powerful thing in the room. And certainly the research on change in psychotherapy says that across models, doesn't matter what model you're using, if you want to look and see who changes, it's always the people who are massively emotionally engaged in the therapy that change. It's the people who allow themselves to go into their emotions that change. And I had somebody say to me the other day, well, in EFIT and in EFT for couples, what do you have to practice? What are the skills you have to practice so that people remember these things that have happened? And you know, this, I love this kind of question because it's funny to someone like me. Okay, it's like, listen, you don't have to practice talking to yourself with love and compassion and holding yourself and calming yourself down and be able to trust yourself. You don't have to practice turning to a partner and knowing how to reach for them with showing your vulnerability and in a way that they can respond You don't have to practice that. Your nervous system absolutely longs for that. And once you know how to go there, you go there. You go there because your whole body says, yes, yes, this is what I want. Bowlby said, our basic need as human beings is for connection with others and also a sense of connection with ourselves, right? That's our basic need. It's not about sex or aggression. It's about this basic need for connection. And disconnection is the problem. Disconnection from self, disconnection from partners, you know, disconnection in families. This is the problem because as human beings, we know that isolation doesn't work. All the research that's coming out now, you know, England even has a minister of loneliness. I love that. I love it. I love it. A minister of loneliness. Okay. But I'd love to know what he does. I'd love to see the memos that come across his, you know, Mary Ann from South Hampstead is lonely in her apartment. How can you help her? Something, you know, but, and of course, it would be nice if he got messages like that because actually there's lots of things he could do to help Mary Ann with her loneliness in, you know, in a little flat in England somewhere. But we're starting to understand who we are as human beings. Who we are as human beings is social bonding beings. And we need to have that sense of intimacy and connection and safety with ourselves as well. If every time you go into your inner world, you feel you're going to be hijacked by difficult, unacceptable emotions, just imagine how terrifying life becomes and how impossible it becomes to relate to others and to even trust yourself and connect with yourself, right? So, you know, people come in and if you listen, especially to trauma survivors, you know, I used to think that the issue with trauma survivors was fear. But the more trauma survivors I see, the more I get that it's about shame, which is, this is my fault. It's my fault I'm like this. It's my fault that I freak out in meetings. And then I go numb for days when I can't even remember what I did. This is my fault. There's something defective about me. My mother was right. She said she didn't want me and I was defective and she was right. So shame. And it is about fear of rejection and abandonment. But more and more, as we work with trauma survivors, what we understand is that when you go down into what we call the core emotion, past all the surface reactive anger or numbing, if you go down into the core emotion, what you meet is this amazing, amazing grief and sadness for what they were deprived of, for what they never got. And of course, behind that grief and sadness is longing, the longing to be seen, to be held, to be loved, to be connected. And once you get that from other people, you can also risk connecting with you, trusting you, thinking that maybe you're not such a bad person. You know, it's becoming and belonging just sort of create each other all the time. And attachment tells us about this. It tells us who we are. If I want to go in and change somebody's life in 20 sessions, which is basically what I want to do, if you think about that, it's quite arrogant, really. You know, they've been going for years and they've got all these patterns. And here comes little Susie Johnson and basically says, okay, you know, I'm going to figure out how to put my finger on the emotional button here and how you're stuck, the patterns you're stuck in. And, you know, I'm going to help you move those patterns and move into much more mental health in 20 hours. I mean, it's quite arrogant. Only we know how to do it and we can do it and we can teach therapists how to do it. And so in EFT and in EFIT, we don't really have a problem with therapist burnout because what we have is what I used to see in my clinic in Ottawa years ago, which is therapists used to come out of the session and go, yes. Okay. If you know where you're going, you have an image, a clear image of health, which attachment gives you. If you know where you're going, you know how to get there. You know the moments of change, the emotional epiphanies and how to create them. Then, you know, therapy becomes a safe adventure for you and for your client. It becomes, well, fun is a pathetic word for it. It becomes intoxicating. I learn from every client I see. And, you know, I learn more. I learn about who we are as human beings and that I have somehow the right image of that, you know, a useful image of that. But I also learn, of course, about how they deal with being human and, you know, and what that means for them. And so they always teach me variations in, you know, how to intervene. But we're always trying to attune to them, to their inner world. We're collaborators with them. We're not the experts, as my favorite cartoon in my local paper says, we're not the great wise ass on the hill. Okay. We're with you. We're with you in therapy. We say, could you help me? We're talking about depression. Could you help me? And you've got 5 diagnoses. We're talking about depression. And let's look at what happens when you use that word. Let's look at the last time you felt it. Let's look at what happens in your body as you talk about it. Let's look at what you say to yourself about yourself as you talk about it. And what we get to when we stay there and when she trusts me is we get to heartbroken. Heartbroken is different than depression. It's much more exact. It's much more specific. And if you are heartbroken, you know what to do. Your body knows what to do. You have to believe in the validity of that hurt. You have to believe you're entitled to it, which your therapist will help you with. And you have to be able to weep for it. It's worth weeping for. You have to feel that your pain is worth weeping for, not just someone else. You know, I give you the message that your pain is worth weeping for, that it's valid and that I can see you. People want to be seen. I can see you in your pain. Your pain makes sense to me. Bowlby said, if you understand attachment, everything that your client tells you, even the strangest things, even the most dysfunctional things, make perfect sense. So, you know, this client bangs her head against the wall to get out of the fog that she goes into to get away from the depression, you know, and what I do with that is I say, that makes perfect sense. You're so desperate. You can't bear the fog anymore. You can't bear the feeling. So you literally do something with your body that takes over until you have a pain in your head. You bang your head against the wall. Yeah, I understand. That makes sense. I don't say, well, that's a very dysfunctional behavior and we have to stop that. And how can we? That's a waste of time. Okay. So you validate the stuckness, the place where people are stuck. You go into it, you make sense of it from an attachment and an emotional point of view. And gradually, she doesn't need to do that anymore. She can talk to me. She can label her feelings. She can talk about her heartbreak. We can look at her heartbreak. We can make sense of it, right? And we can turn it into weeping and then maybe reaching for her husband, which she's never done, even though she knows he loves her. You know, she knows that, but she still doesn't let him in. She starts to be able to let him in. She starts to be able to draw boundaries with her family. It's like saying, no, we're getting married and you're not invited. None of you. I don't want to see any of you. You know, I grew up alone and invisible and hurting and none of you cared. So no, you're not coming to my wedding. And, you know, this person who's told me at the beginning I'm defective starts to be able to tell me I can deal with my feelings. I feel this sense of balance. I don't know really where it's coming from. I can turn and talk to my partner. When the darkness comes for me, it's not so dark. And I can tell my partner the darkness is coming for me and he can hold me and it goes away, right? This is functional emotional regulation, right? To be able to find that balance, to order your inner experience. This is what an EFT therapist does. We hold people's experience. We go to the heart of the matter, the emotional reality. We hold it for people in a way that makes sense to them so that they can tolerate it and explore it. That's what we basically do. And it's very, 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 very powerful. And it's very efficient. And it scares most people half to death, because in our world, emotion is the, you know, we like it in the movies because it's removed. But I still think that as a discipline, we're pretty emotion phobic. If you've noticed, we went from insight, analytic, into behaviorism, thoughts, change your thoughts, you'll change you. And then I thought, right. And then we went to cognition, just cognition. And I thought, right, here comes emotion. No. Oh, no, no. We leapt into the body and somatic therapies and the brain. Well, what about emotion? Oh, goodness me, don't touch that. That's like dangerous stuff. Okay, it's, you get out of control, and right. And I think still as a culture, you know, we don't quite know what to do with emotion when it's ours, you know.
You just summed up hundreds of years of clinical history. Yes. Like that, which is actually quite helpful. I'm sure any graduate student listening is going, oh my gosh, replay. That, okay, that's how all the theories fit together. Here we are. It all makes sense now. For our listeners who are new to EFIT and potentially even new to EFT, what I'm hearing is that you're describing a model that is really primarily about stance, that the clinician is geared at creating a safe space, as you said, with relentless empathy formed with attachment and attunement. And then the interventions tumble out of that. For our listeners who are very well trained in these manualized practices, alphabet soup, if you will, do you feel like the EFIT model can really layer on top of that? How do you feel it fitting together in terms of the practical alphabet soup that exists in our field right now?
I think having a lot of ideas about possible interventions, possible ways to go, is good. It's like carrying a little bag along with you. But I think if you're going to be an effective therapist, you need a coherent model. And it needs to be a model that includes who people are, not just, oh, I'll use this intervention here, or I'll use that intervention there. That's kind of a fix-it model of, oh, I'll do a bit of this and I'll do a bit of that. And I think that's unlikely to be effective. I think you need a coherent model to lead people into coherence, into a sense of who they are. What we do, we use sort of micro skills from Rogers, like asking simple questions, what's happening for you right now? It's all about how you're putting your experience together in the moment now. It's a present therapy. It happens in the present. What's happening for you right now? I notice you're looking down, that your face changes when you talk about this. Could you help me? What's happening? Where do you feel this? What happens to you when? We use questions. We heighten emotion by repeating it, by using images, by validating it, right? We create interactions. We turn conversations, if you like, with partners and with self into certain dramas. So we do all that, but we put it together in a sort of macro intervention sequence that we call the EFT Tango. We call it the tango because until COVID, I used to dance Argentine tango about 10 hours a week. And Argentine tango is not about sex. Dancing with the Stars is boring. Argentine tango...
I disagree.
Oh, all right. Okay. Argentine tango is about attunement. It's about standing up in front of a perfect stranger and breathing with them and starting to change your weight with them and finding them, finding the place where you're in tune and using the emotional music as a structure and then moving together. And that synchrony of movement and connection is what human beings long for. That's why we sing together, we dance together. That's why armies march together in formation. We long for that synchrony, right? So I call it the tango. And if you look at it with couples or with individuals, we go in and we create an alliance, and then we go in and we look at the patterns of affect regulation that we do use inside to create our inner world, and we look at the patterns that the behaviors that we do habitually with other people. And we look at those patterns and we look at how they reflect our inner world, our pain, our stuck places, our fears, our needs, right? And we look at that and we look at how the pattern constantly creates the distress that we're trying to move away from, right? So my client, she comes and tells me, she doesn't tell me I'm depressed, she tells me I'm angry all the time. My blood boils. But then when we look at that anger, which is on the surface, and it's very difficult for her to go there, we go into, actually, there's a little thing that happens in the anger, which is kind of like a shakiness in her chest. But she doesn't want to talk about that. Okay. But when she feels the shakiness in her chest, you know, what does she say to herself? She says, this is pathetic. I'm pathetic. Here comes these emotions again. There's nothing I can do. There's something wrong with me, right? I need out. I need to escape. And what does she do? She goes into a fog, right? And the fog feels great for a while. This is the lady who says, I don't want to feel and I can't live numb. She feels great for a while, the fog, and she's sort of not there, right? But then after a while, the fog feels bad too. So then she used to bang her head on the wall. Now, as a sort of older adult, she doesn't bang her head in the wall. She goes into her room, closes the door, and won't talk to anyone for a couple of days, including her husband. She shuts down and shuts everybody out. And then she comes out, and after a couple of days, the same thing happens again. This is the pattern of interpersonal connection and intrapsychic connection that she's caught in. And we talk about that. We talk about what that's about. It always makes sense from an attachment point of view. It's about growing up in a family where your three brothers are abusing you every night and where the rest of the family act like nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. So you get, I am alone. I am alone. I am invisible. I don't matter. And this for human beings is from an evolutionary safety point of view, from a survival point of view, this is the most disastrous message you can give a child, right? So she has lived with that until she was 16, when she exploded in anger. And then, of course, her family basically said, you're being ridiculous. These were just childhood mistakes. You should just get over this, right? This is the message again. You're invisible. Your pain doesn't matter, right? So this is classic. So we talk about this and we make sense of her pain. We make sense of the way she deals with her emotions, which keeps her stuck. Her protection becomes a prison. We make sense of all that with her. And she starts to get her balance. She starts to be able to look at this to step back and look at this. And the message is, it is the process you're caught in that's the problem, not you. You are not bad or defective. You're a human being who is in an impossible situation. And it's the process of how you learn to deal with that situation, you know, that you're caught in, you're stuck. And then we go into the emotion, which she never allows, which is the sadness underneath the depression. And we find out what the core feeling is. Is it fear? Is it shame? Is it sadness? And with her, it's heartbreak. Okay. And we go into that to the point where she can name it. And that gives her power over it. She can tolerate it. She can explore it. She can begin to actually feel it with me in the session. And I can validate it. And in EFIT, validation doesn't mean sympathizing with somebody. It means joining with them in the experience. So I might say, well, this is all online. So I might say, you know, when you say this and you talk about this feeling in your chest, I feel like I can feel that. I can feel that feeling in my chest. I can't imagine what that was like for you. And then we talk about how she used to hide under her bed as a child. And we go into that powerful image and we go through move one, which is to show you the patterns you're caught in. We go through move two of the tango, which is to take you into the emotion that you're avoiding all the time. and show you it makes sense, you can tolerate it, right? You can explore it. And then we grab the most potent emotion there, which for her is grief and sadness. And then we create a drama. In move three of the tango, we create a drama. So you say, can you see that little girl hiding under the bed, holding onto her dollies, hoping her brothers aren't going to come tonight? And when I first ask her, she says, no, I can't see her. No, I don't want to see. You'd be amazed how common this is. This happens again and again and again. These patterns, you know, we're the same. We're different, but we're the same. So people say, no, I can't see the face of that little 11-year-old. No, I can't see the face of the person under the, because of course not. They've kept it aside for years. But gradually I say, so could you help me? You can't see. I reflect the block. We don't tell people get past the block. They can't. I reflect the block and say, that's too hard, yeah? That's too hard. You want to tell me, Sue? Don't ask me to see her under the bed. I can talk about her from a distance, but it's too hard to actually see her. Don't ask me, yeah? And I accept her reluctance. The next time she comes in and she does it, okay? And she says, yes, I can see her. I go back there and she says, yes, I can see her. I go back to the emotionally loaded moment, right? When the most vulnerable sense of self was up and running and couldn't be dealt with, right? And she says, I say, and we talk about that. What does she look like? She's holding her toy. She's terrified. Is she mostly terrified? No, she's sad, 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 sad. And what would you like to say to her? I don't know. That's too difficult. So you slice it thinner. You know, what do you feel as you look at her? I feel sad for her. Now we're moving. Okay. I feel sad for her. I feel compassion for self, right? I feel sad for her and say, yeah. And so what would you like to do? She says, I'd like to crawl under the bed and hold her. I say, right. And when I'm doing this, I'm using a slow, low voice because you have to play the music of a lullaby to get people to stay with this pain. If you say it like this, please believe me, it won't work, which is why therapists have to look at their own tapes because you don't know how you say it unless you look, okay? Believe me, you don't know. I used to think I was being empathic when in fact I was just like a runaway train rabbiting on to people. Right, telling them what I knew and they didn't. That was a waste of time, right? And I twigged to that by looking at my tapes. So you go low and slow and you say, like a mother with a lullaby, what is happening for you right now? She says, I can see her and I'm going to go and hold her. I say, yeah, good. Can you tell her? I want to hold you. I want to hold you. She says, yes, I'm going to hold you now because we escaped. Me, we escaped. We got away. We're all right now. We escaped. And here I am and I'm going to hold you. Say, good, good. And she weeps. So she doesn't need to bang her head on the wall or go into the fog anymore because the experience that she's been avoiding like crazy is out there and she's tolerated it and connected with it and is processing it with balance. So then she comes in the next week and starts talking about how she doesn't understand where the depression has gone. And I say, right.
You know, let's go find it.
Yeah, like, you know, so then we talk about what they've gone through. We talk about what they've gone in move four of the tango. We talk about, look at what you just did. Isn't this amazing? We try to help them integrate it. And move five, we validate, we say, people say, well, I can't really change. And we say, look at what you did in this session. You are changing. This is amazing. Look at what you did already. You're changing, right? This is incredible that you did this. And we validate. We validate the way you validate your dog, not the way you validate a distant employee. We don't say, that's very good, James. We say, oh, yes. If you look at how people are with their dogs, all their attachment stuff comes out with their dogs. You say, oh, you're such a good boy. Oh, you're the most beautiful, beautiful doggy. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. This is how I talk to my dogs. Okay. So, you know, we validate by saying, and we're not being phony here. we mean it. We validate by saying, that was very brave, wasn't it? That took a lot of courage, didn't it? For you to see that little girl and go in and hold her. That's amazing. That's amazing what you did there. Yeah? Can you see how amazing that is? When I'm with you in that, I'm just touched. I'm blown away that you could do that. That's just so amazing, right? That's made my day. That's how you validate, not from an impersonal sort of jolly good, you know, that was a good exercise point of view. So you do this tango again and again and again, and you might just do two bits of it in a session, or you might do it all, or you can do it on a very superficial level or in a very deep level. You're in the beginning, I might say to her, you know, your childhood was really distressing. Do you ever think of that little girl? Can you see her? That's very superficial, you know. And she says, no, and I don't want to think about her. And that's not going to help. How's that going to help me to think about her? I don't think it's going to help me at all. So I get it. I get it. Okay. You know, and then I watch her. And after I've said this to her, she takes swigs from her a water thing. She does something with tissues. She messes about with pens and things on her desk. So I know, okay, this is exit stuff, right? She's into, you know, doing all kinds of things to get out of this emotional place. All I did was just ask her a question. So that tells me how vulnerable she is and how difficult it is for her to feel. So I know that before she says to me, I don't want to feel. What's the point? It's interesting, you know, clients say, you know, what's the point? I had gentlemen say to me, you're a therapist, so you're going to try and persuade me that I'm not all these terrible things that I've just told you I am. I said, oh, am I? Yes, okay. He says, yes. And so you're wasting your breath. You know, I don't know why I'm here, because therapists can't deal with me. And you're wasting your breath because I am those things, and that's the truth. I say, okay. So he's inviting me to have a contest with him. Well, that's dumb. I'm not going to do that. So what I start saying is, of course you feel this way about you. How else would you feel? You were invisible, weren't you? So of course you can't see the soft, sensitive parts of Tao, because they were absolutely not allowed, were they, in your family? So of course you can't. When I ask you if you can see little 11-year-old Tao when all this pain started to happen, you say, no, I can't see him. All you can see is the things that your fathers and brothers told you, which is that you're not strong enough, you're not male enough. That's all you can hear, because that's the music you've listened to for years. Makes perfect sense. How would it be differently? Of course you feel this way about yourself. And he doesn't quite know what to do with that, because what I'm supposed to do is fight him, right, and tell him, no, you're not a traitor. No, you're not a, right? But that's craziness. You don't go in there. You know, that would be, I don't know what that would be. I think he'd had some CBT and he'd had a few other therapies. But he was a difficult client, you know, but he told you from the beginning, I'm going to be a difficult client, which was very considerate of him. It was like, oh, you're all right. Okay, fine. And he was okay. Well, he was, but he was also a fascinating client. So we a session with him, with that client, we are putting out a course on the ICEF site, and also with Pessy, who we work with a lot. We're putting out a course in a couple of weeks called a consultation in EFIT, where we look at trauma survivors and we look at where therapists get stuck, including us. And at the beginning of that course, I show a whole session of me working with this gentleman and talk about how I would get stuck with him and feel exhausted at the end of the session. And then my wonderful colleague, Leanne Campbell, also shows a session where she felt stuck. And then we have other therapists bringing in places where they felt stuck. Because, you know, part of what we don't talk about much in psychotherapy is every therapist gets stuck. Every therapist, unless you're sitting there doing nothing and following a very set protocol, well, of course, you're not going to get stuck then because you're just following a protocol. But, you know, if you're following your client, and their reality is chaotic, you're going to get stuck. And that's the truth. And so key thing in therapy is, what do you do when you're stuck? You know, and do you have a map for what's going on and what's happening and where you need to move to get unstuck? And if you don't, then I think therapy becomes amazingly stressful for the therapist and often not so effective for the client. You seem to have covered a lot of things here in a very short time. I hope I haven't spoken too fast or too overwhelmingly.
Not for me. I'm just eating it up. It's so wonderful to listen to you talk and to tell these stories, because I think it provides such a framework, because we do get stuck. And I think that's the beauty of the models that are really focused on stance, not necessarily on intervention. Because we're walking into a session, and I remember when I was a wee baby therapist, feeling like I needed to walk in with all these preparations where it's like, well, yeah, and then I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. And then the person that's in front of you is different than the person that they were a week ago when they were sitting in front of you. So when you were talking about that interpersonal conflict at work, and you're ready to tackle that again this week, and that's not at all what they're talking about, you go, what do I do? And I think it's really powerful what you're suggesting, because it's so fundamentally core to the art of healing, to be with somebody. And I think it takes off a lot of the pressure and helps us get past that notorious imposter syndrome.
Yes.
We don't know what to do. We don't know how to do it. And I think that confidence is obviously going to play out with our clients too. If we are fumbling in the dark, how can we be secure with them and attune when we're so distracted by our own internal process of not knowing what to say next?
I think that's true. And, you know, it, what comes up for me when you say that is, sometimes all you have is you, not a set of interventions. Like Henny, the woman in the primer that I talked about, the really, really traumatized lady, she was completely, well, we gave her a scale, a trauma scale, and she was off the charts in terms of dissociation. And for the first 10 sessions, I could not even make sense of her story, okay? I couldn't even sort of put it together because it was so disjointed and so disrupted. And but somewhere around the fourth session, she said, you're different. I said, oh, okay, am I? She said, yes, you're different. She said, you're not afraid of my pain, are you? And I thought about it, because I understood that I was getting that this woman was one of the most traumatized people I'd ever worked with. So I thought about it. I thought, am I afraid of her pain? You know, Rogers said you have to be authentic with your clients. You have to show up as a real human being. And that's why therapy is always an art, right? And not can't ever just be a science. You have to be authentic. Because they know when you're not, right? They know. They know in their nervous system, right? Maybe not in their prefrontal cortex. So I said, no, I don't think I am afraid of your pain. She said, why aren't you then? Everyone else is, including me. And I said, I think it's because I trust that when we really get to that pain, I'll recognize it, and I'll have seen it before, and I'll know how to be with you in it, and we'll deal with it together. I didn't say I got the answer, right? Which is a lie, right? And often to these deep existential fears and crises and triggers, there is no answer. There is your ability to tolerate it and face it and, you know, have it instead of here, have it out there, right? That's what it's about. So she nodded, and she still ran me around the houses for another set of sessions. And I thought to myself, which is very difficult, we all have our personalities. I'm an amazingly impatient person, okay? Somebody said to me the other day, Sue, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. And I said, forget that. I'm not interested in Rome being built in a day. I want it built by 11:30, okay? And they just roared with laughter. But it's true. You know, I thought, okay, let's go. No, wait. You have to, Sue, you got to wait. Well, how long have I got to wait? You got to wait and see when she's ready. Took about 10 sessions, which is a lot for me. Okay. I'm used to really being able to go in pretty fast because I do have a map to this process and people's inner world. And I had to wait. And then in session 10, I took what I felt like was a risk and I asked her about her emotion, and she didn't go off on me into 1,000 different stories that didn't make sense. For a moment, she was with me, you know, and I started to say, you know, I'm having a real hard time piecing your history together and understanding, you know, what you're telling me, because it feels like such chaos. It must feel that way to you too, inside. And she says, yes. And then we're off. Then somehow she's opened a door. But, you know, you have to tune yourself to the client's ability to tolerate things. You have to pace, you know, you have to. And when people can't do something, you say, that's fine. I asked you to see the little vulnerable part of you at a time when you said that you were aware of that vulnerability, and you're telling me that that's too hard. Well, of course it's hard. Of course it's hard. And then we're going to talk about for the next half an hour about it's hard, and I'm going to validate you. And that's the best way I have of making sure that when you come back in next time, you'll be willing to go there. You know, not to say, well, do you understand that this is dysfunctional behavior and da 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 da. You know, it's relentless empathy. Your job, Bobby said, if you understand the attachment needs and longings, everything that people do is perfectly reasonable. And if it doesn't look like that to you, work harder. Find how it's perfectly reasonable for this man to be sitting in your office calling his wife a whore 30 times in a session, when it's really obvious that she's the only thing between him and the abyss, and he's a soldier, and without her, he's going to commit suicide. But he's driving her away with everything he's got by calling her a whore. And he's driven all the therapists away, and he's driven all the army psychiatrists away. And now he's driving me away because I don't want to give him relentless empathy. I don't like him, right? And so I have to sit with that and say, okay, how does this make sense from an attachment point of view? It makes sense because what he's saying to her is, prove to me you love me. Because if you don't love me, the world is black and meaningless and I want to die. Prove to me you love me. So I'm going to bring up this thing that happened 30 years ago that I think happened. I think you had a brief affair. I'm sure she didn't. Okay, but it's his thing. And it happened at a particular time in his life. And that makes sense too when you go into it. You know, he'd allowed himself to actually feel vulnerable with her. And suddenly, you know, he finds out that she's gone for coffee with a student while he was away on the weekend. And suddenly he knows that she made love with this student. And, you know, everything spins out from there. And now he's vulnerable again, retiring from the army. And he's screaming at her. And everyone's caught up in his screaming. And nobody hears the frantic, desperate attachment message underneath, which is, and neither do I in the first two sessions because he's so aversive. Prove to me you love me. Well, of course, nobody can prove to you they love you. But, you know, I get it. And when I start to get it and reflect it to him, a whole new person turns up, the person who cries rather than screaming at his partner, a person who starts to weep and says that nobody's ever loved him and he doesn't believe anyone could ever love him. And that must be her too. And he starts to weep. And that's a whole different client than the client who walked in the first two sessions screaming his head off. And, you know, the military psychiatrist said, he's impossible, so we can't deal with him. So let's see what you can do. I thought, oh, that's a nice professional respectful invitation that you're giving me, you turkey. But anyway, I didn't say that. I said, yes, let's see what I can do. So it was very nice to be able to phone that guy up after 10 sessions and say, I'm happy to report that your client's PTSD symptoms are down, that he wants to go off his medication, that his connection with his wife is much better, and that he's moving away to go and live with his relatives in another province. And there's a long silence on the phone. He said, how many times did you see him? I said, 10 sessions.
Done and done.
That's right. Anyway, I think we're running out of time. I'm not sure.
I have been just delighted to have you, Dr. Johnson. It is such an unbelievable honor to hear you speak so openly about what's really probably the most complicated part of therapy, which is being in the room and the idea of helping people toward growth. How do we do that? For our listeners that are so intrigued by what you've presented today, what is the best way to get better trained in EFIT and begin embodying this model?
Well, I would hope that you'd buy the primer and read it. We feel pretty good about it. It's by Kat Johnson and Campbell with Routledge, the primer of EFIT. I'd hope that you'd go on our site at ISEFT, and also PESI does a lot of work with us, and look at the different workshops that we've done on EFIT. There's quite a few of them on different topics. Okay. A lot on trauma, because we're obsessed with trauma. Okay. So a lot, and that's the clients we get right now. We get vets, and we get people who've got complex PTSD, who've been abused as children. Okay. And have long-term mental health problems. Those are kind of the folks we get. We get indigenous folks who've been totally traumatized. A lot of our work is with that population.
I believe you are driving the charge of bringing emotion into the field, and delighted
for it. I'm trying.
It's
a tricky one. I don't think people really want to know. They don't want to know. It's too... Emotion is like dynamite. If you don't know how to handle it, it's scary. If you know how to handle it, you can move mountains with it. I think that's a rather unfortunate image, actually, because it makes it dangerous. But anyway, you get the idea.
Thank you again from the bottom of my heart for joining us today, Dr. Sue Johnson.
I'm most welcome. It's been lovely to be with you.
You've just finished listening to another exclusive continuing ed podcast by Clearly Clinical. If you like what you just heard and you need continuing ed credits, please visit us at clearlyclinical.com to check out our one-year membership, where you'll have access to our growing library of continuing ed podcast courses. Clearly Clinical, where our goal is to help you learn, grow, and shine.